Okay, I have a couple of housekeeping points. First, I wrote up on the board, we haven't had Q&A for a while, I'll do it this afternoon for anybody who's interested. Secondly, this only indirectly affects you, but tomorrow a high school class is visiting the 11 o'clock section, and to make sure we don't run out of room, a couple of people from that class will be attending. It might be a little cozy tomorrow afternoon, so we'll see. The room seems a little fuller than usual. You'll know why. And then the third housekeeping issue is there is a case that was just argued in the Washington Supreme Court. For those of you who get TVW, I'm trying to get to see if they'll rebroadcast it. I saw it over the weekend. The name of the case is Philippides. It is actually a consolidated case, four different cases involving the death of adult children, for which the parents are claiming damages under the Washington wrongful death statute. And at stake is the interpretation of the statute and whether it is limited to those children upon whom the parents were financially, economically dependent, or whether it also includes those parents who are emotionally dependent on their children. It's an extended argument. They normally limit the parties to 20 minutes, maybe even 30 minutes per side. This one, I think they expanded it, so the whole thing's about an hour and a half. So again, I'm trying to find the time when this will be periodically rebroadcast, the Supreme Court arguments on Channel 5. I think that's at least that's where Comcast has it on my station, or my cable package. So I'll try to email you so that you can record this. I didn't see the whole thing, but one of the advocates is Phil Talmadge, who is a former Washington Supreme Court justice, now returning to private practice, appearing before his old colleagues on the court. He's also a candidate for governor, as you may know. Another advocate is Brian Harnato, who teaches our appellate advocacy, and I think he teaches a course on Washington constitutional law. And what I was able to catch of the argument was an amazing sort of almost exam question in its kaleidoscopic character. Questions about whether or not the statute defines the limits of what the court can do from a common law perspective, whether there's nothing left of the common law, essentially going back to the Moraine versus States Marine Lines, Baker versus Bolton, all the issues about wrongful death. A question about what kind of relationships count. Is there something, did the legislature mean to say that a financial relationship between parent and child is more important than an emotional relationship between parent and child? Questions about what the public policy impact would be, whether this creates a new cause of action, whether that's something the court is empowered to do. If the court read support to mean not only financial, economic support, but also emotional support, would that create a new cause of action, or is that, you know, simply part of the interpretive process that the court is entitled to do? So again, I what I saw of it, I would highly recommend in terms of almost a sort of review of the issues that we've covered. It's also a very good illustration of the way in which these issues are in flux. That is, rather than having a nice determinate answer, even if we've got a statute, again, is you imagine yourself getting an exam on December 11th that will have attached to it a statute that you will be called upon to interpret, remember that that's exactly what the Supreme Court is doing in front of your eyes as you watch this Supreme Court argument, and it's very much an open question. I talked to Brian Harnito this morning. I'm trying to get some of the briefs from the case so that those of you who are interested can follow up by reading the briefs filed by the parties. Brian told me the Supreme Court hearing room was full of lawyers. Not only were there lots of parties in the case because there were consolidated cases, but there were lots of people interested in sort of reading the tea leaves as to where the court was going to go with this. I asked Brian what his impression was, and he said, as far as I could tell, the court was pretty deeply conflicted. They saw, on the one hand, the injustice of saying, well, gee, this parent who's economically dependent upon a child gets to recover, but this parent who's emotionally dependent on the child doesn't get to recover. At the same time, they were reluctant to assert on the court's behalf a power, in effect, to treat the legislative definition or the legislative description as though it were sort of the starting point for the court to make of it what it would. So, again, I'll try to provide you with some more information so that you can look it up. If you want to, even now, you can go to the Supreme Court's, watch the Supreme Court, or to TVW's website, and TVW has all of the Supreme Court oral arguments archived. You can get the audio either in the Windows Media format or in Real Player format, download them in effect an MP3 kind of file, and listen to the oral argument. As I say, I'm going to try to get you the video version of it because it's kind of nice to connect the face with the voice. Okay, any other housekeeping issues before we return to the... Yes, Mr. Sullivan. Oh, good point. If you would, I'll just take them as they come. I'll try to begin, thank you for reminding me, try to begin class just by reminding you that if you brought your exam, I need to get the original exam back. I don't need the checklist or the comment sheet. I just need the exam itself. If, you know, it got stolen out of your car, it's not like there's a penalty attached to not getting it back to me, but I appreciate once you're done with it, being able to return it for its archival purposes when all of you become nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court and they do a thorough review of your life. I want to have that exam in hand. Okay. Now, I think I left any other housekeeping issues? Okay. I left on the verge of doing Taylor versus Karapeti. I think I mentioned I would cover it only briefly. Obviously, the difference between the majority and the concurring opinion, the concurring opinion thinks the majority should have left it simply with the finding on the statute of limitations. The majority felt compelled to explain that in addition to the statute of limitations, there were public policy reasons why the court should never acknowledge such a cause of action. I had a very animated discussion with a student after the 11 o'clock section who was quite troubled by the court's dismissal of this cause of action and in his view, the imposition of the court's, of these particular judges' ideas of public policy on what would otherwise be the straightforward issues of breach, causation, and damages. And not to summarize the entire conversation, but essentially my counterargument to him, I wasn't asking him to accept the court's the majority opinion on its merits, but what I said was, in effect, every time a court encounters a claim for tort compensation, it considers as part of the structuring of tort compensation remedies its ideas, as it understands them to be, of these larger issues of public policy. So as I pointed out to this student, once upon a time there was a cause of action for what was called alienation of affections, so that if someone began a relationship with my wife that eventually flowered to the point where my wife decided to leave me, once upon a time I could, if I were able to establish the factual basis for it, I could sue this third party for alienation of affections. And over time, the court said, no, we're not going to do that. What do you think, your wife is your property? No, we're not in the business of deciding whether you were happily married before this guy stole your woman away, or whether there were underlying problems in the marriage that, the courts just shouldn't be doing this. This is a bad idea. So, again, and I would venture to say that most people today thought the court did the right thing by saying, as a matter of public policy, it's a bad idea for the tort system to be engaged in evaluating this kind of a claim. Now, again, whether you disagree with the court in the alienation of affections case or you disagree with the court, again, it's all dicta, as the concurring opinion points out. There is an alternate basis for the court's holding. So all of the discussion about the public policy ramifications of a wrongful life claim are, to that extent, unnecessary for the court to reach the conclusion that the case ought to be dismissed. But as it turns out, the rationale utilized by the majority was adopted by the Michigan legislature later on. It was sort of converted into a statute that is similar to the one that I think I reference at the end here, the Minnesota statute. No, it's actually not at the end of this. It was earlier. Yeah, it's on page 67, right-hand column, note number 3. Again, by statute, some courts may say, some legislatures will say, in effect, we don't want this. Now, again, my purpose in bringing this to your attention is so that you, again, have some idea of what a case like the Harbison case would raise if you were faced with it where you didn't know the law of your particular jurisdiction. Let me summarize for you what we have learned along the way here with respect to these different tort claims. The first we talked about was wrongful birth. And again, this is the claim brought by the parents, where the parents say, but for the defendant's negligence, I would not have had this child. The child is a source of injury to me. And you want to be clear that the case you're dealing with is, in fact, a wrongful birth case, not what I would call a garden variety medical malpractice or product liability claim, where the defendant's negligence caused a child who would otherwise have been healthy to suffer from brain damage or some other condition. A wrongful birth claim is one where the defendant's negligence causes a child to be born who would otherwise not have been born. Now, there are two situations we need to review. One is the case where the child is born healthy, as in Arizona Health Sciences Center. What then? The jurisdictions essentially are split. Some, like the Arizona Health Sciences Center case, say, well, this is like any other tort claim. Let's find out what damage the plaintiff suffered, what damage the parent suffered from the birth caused by the defendant's negligence. Let's offset that, as they said in Arizona Health Sciences Center, by the benefit the parents obtained, offsetting again the damage that they suffered, and let those chips fall where they may. By contrast, some jurisdictions like Washington say, again, for reasons of public policy and otherwise, they say, no, with respect to the birth of a healthy child, even one caused by the negligence of the defendant, the parents are not entitled to damages aside from the childbirth itself. So, lost wages during pregnancy, the cost, hospital bill, the medical costs, again, of the childbirth, but the birth of the healthy child in many jurisdictions is viewed as something not compensable, even though, again, the facts show that the defendant's negligence, in effect, caused the birth of the child. By contrast, where the child is born disabled in some way, most permit a recovery along the lines of the Harbison case. The reasoning being that, as we talked about before, in the case of a child born with some substantial disability, it's no longer a case in which we can simply say, count your blessings. So again, most jurisdictions would say the parents are entitled to a recovery of damages where the defendant's negligence results in the birth of a child who suffers from disability. Now, we don't know exactly where the line would be drawn. Recalling in Harbison, the parents anticipated the birth of a child that might have cleft palate or some other more limited disability. Does that count as a Harbison rule kind of case, or does the disability have to be something more substantial, like the fetal height Antoine syndrome or spina bifida or some other major disability that is covered elsewhere? But assuming we have some criterion for figuring out what a disability is, most jurisdictions would say, go ahead, grant the parents a recovery. The other thing we talked about, again, was a wrongful life claim where the child is bringing the action. And this, again, is the one that some legislatures have said, no, not going to do that. But other jurisdictions, like Washington and the Harbison case, would say we should permit the child to recover economic damages post-majority. So again, we're going to allow, as in the Harbison case, the child to receive an award reflecting the cost for medical care, rehabilitative care, what have you, that kick in after the parent's obligation ends when the child reaches the age of majority. Most In fact, I don't know of a single case that has recognized a claim for non-economic damages in a wrongful life claim. Again, the Harbison Court thought that the apple of life with disabilities could not meaningfully be compared to the orange of no existence at all, and therefore non-economic damages ought not to be awarded at all. So again, this tends to be a kind of small tail on a large dog, where the major claim would be the wrongful birth claim by the parents. That's where most of the damages would be. The wrongful life claim would kind of tag along afterward. Maybe you get it, maybe this jurisdiction rejects it altogether. Even if you get it, the damages are postponed and they're of an economic nature only. Questions about the rules here for wrongful birth, wrongful life? Most of the jurisdictions have not drawn a line between economic and non-economic damages to say, well, you can recover the economic but not the non-economic. Most have said, if they go the Arizona Health Sciences Center direction of saying, hey, we don't have a problem with the concept of doing this, let's do the best we can to calculate the damages, they've allowed both economic and non-economic. Again, the split that we've seen for economic and non-economic damages is both in the wrongful life area, but also reminiscent back to the wrongful death damages, where in setting up the wrongful death recoveries, many jurisdictions have chosen to say, we want to recognize the economic loss. We don't have any way to compensate people for the non-economic loss when somebody is the subject of wrongful death. So again, this impulse to split them will appear from time to time, but in this area, those jurisdictions that say we want to recognize a wrongful birth claim, they haven't drawn that line. Other questions about wrongful birth, wrongful life? Mr. Simpson. It won't be visible to you. That is, the only statute I'm going to give you on the exam will be a wrongful death statute. So there, you know, it may turn out that, as I think I've described before, my little Ouija board. When I prepare the exam, I generate five random numbers, which are a zip code. The zip code, then I look it up. Find out what state is this zip code located in, and that's the jurisdiction. If it's Missouri or Montana or Illinois or Texas or wherever it is, that's the jurisdiction for purposes of this exam. It's very possible that such a jurisdiction will have a wrongful birth or wrongful life statute, but I won't give it to you. The only statute I'm looking for purposes of this exam will be a wrongful death statute. Any other questions before we transition here into Dillon versus Legg? Okay, as I said before, this Filippides case that the Washington Supreme Court is wrestling with raised many of the same issues regarding the extension of liability. If I could sort of diagram what's going on here, we have a situation in which the defendant has injured somebody, a victim, and then we begin to get these sort of concentric circles of people who say, a la John Donne, no man is an island. When the bell tolls, it tolls for me or for thee or whatever he said. Who is entitled to make a claim when there's a serious injury to the victim, and then you have related parties, that's kind of my heading here, related parties, who line up and say, I got injured too. And Dillon versus Legg is kind of our launch pad for this whole discussion, in part because it is California, is a significant, California has exerted a sort of, been the leading edge of a lot of developments in tort laws, we'll see. A lot of the cases you read wind up being from California, as a very populous state, very dynamic state, has produced a lot of sort of cutting edge stuff. The other reason that Dillon versus Legg shows up, for example, in the next case of Hagel versus McMahon is because this case states the issue pretty well, and even if you decide you want to tweak the criteria for deciding these cases, you won't stray very far from the kind of analytical framework in which the case is set. Dillon versus Legg also provides a kind of visual image of what we're looking at in cases of this type. So with that introduction, I'd like to have somebody just lay the facts and the kind of background of Dillon versus Legg out, and then we can talk about where to go with it. Once. Yes. Mr. Hall. Okay, so again, just the visual setup here, the geometry of it. Defendant's driving down the street. The two girls are crossing in the crosswalk. Defendant strikes the decedent, the daughter. She is fatally injured. The sister is also in the crosswalk, but not physically hurt. The mom is apparently standing on the porch or otherwise in a position of safety, but watches in obvious shock and horror as her daughter's life is taken from her as she watches. Now, both the sister and the mother file these claims against the defendant, and first of all, there's some history here in California of how cases like this had been handled in the past. Going back before this Amaya versus Home Ice, would the sister have been able to recover in prior to Amaya versus Home Ice? Okay. Actually, the Amaya case establishes the zone of danger test. Prior to that, there had actually been a physical impact test. So that prior to Amaya versus Home Ice, the threshold you had to meet was that there had to be a physical touching of some kind. If the vehicle actually physically touched the sister, she's eligible. But if it misses her, sorry, count yourself lucky, try to get over it. Amaya versus Home Ice says, no, this is crazy, whether it physically touches you or not. If you're standing there and the car goes whizzing past you, your sister's body goes flying in the air, are we supposed to say, hey, no harm, no foul? No. Let's adopt a test that says, so long as you were in a zone of physical danger, as far as you could tell, the car could just as easily have hit you as hit her, then you're within that zone that makes you eligible for recovery. But under the rule of Amaya versus Home Ice, would the mom be able to recover? Right. As long as she wasn't physically imperiled, she's in a position of safety, observing this again in horror. The court would say to her what it, prior to Amaya versus Home Ice, it would have said to the sister, which is, in effect, sorry, you haven't really been hurt. Well, and the question, obviously, and this is why I found this Filippides case so interesting to listen to, as the lawyers and the judges exchanged, you know, questions and arguments back and forth about the scope of liability, about what kinds of injuries were eligible for compensation and which ones weren't, that What you see again in Dillon versus Legg is this steady progression, that it seems as though we have a trend line here, that we start with a very restrictive view of who's eligible, but as we get more thoughtful about this, we begin to kind of lower the barrier. Now, if you believe that the mom, if you believe that there is an artificial line being drawn between the sister and the mom, what about the line drawn between the mom and the dad? Suppose, that's not in the case, but for purposes of discussion, suppose the dad's in the backyard mowing the lawn. He vaguely hears something over the roar of the lawnmower engine, the squeal of brakes, but it isn't until 2 minutes later when somebody comes, you know, his wife comes running or some neighbor comes running, you know, in a terror, or he comes out and he sees his daughter's lifeless body on the pavement. You know, by that time, they've been trying to administer first aid to her. He doesn't see any of the, he doesn't watch his daughter's body being hit, but he sees the after effects. Would he qualify? What happens if he's running an errand and he gets a frantic call on his cell phone and he races back, and just as they're putting his daughter's body into the ambulance, he arrives and follows the ambulance to the hospital. What if he only sees her in the hospital? What if he's on a business trip in Chicago? Gets there 24 hours. Any of these lines to say, nope, sorry, Dad, you've gone too far there. We could have helped you if you were only on this side of the line, but now you're over on that side of the line. Sorry, you don't qualify anymore. Any of these lines that we draw appear to be arbitrary, indefensible. We're sort of in this no man's land. We're looking for a kind of defensible perimeter here where we can, you know, put up our line of defense, instead of which we're out here in this no man's land and we keep getting pushed around here because we have no place to dig in and defend the ground we're on. Mr. Sides. Well, it, in many ways, it's the same kind of line drawing problem, I think one of the differences is that courts are going to be in the market for some more fixed criterion. That is, in the Paulsgraf case, Cardozo asks a more general question. Is this plaintiff, or was this plaintiff, in a position where the defendant could reasonably foresee the potential of injury and therefore owed a duty to this plaintiff? If so, the plaintiff has a basis for claiming negligence and we're off to the races. By contrast, if the defendant couldn't reasonably foresee the plaintiff, then this plaintiff is not eligible for a tort recovery because the defendant owed her no duty. Rather than have that kind of general question to be posed, this court and other courts would like some more specific criteria, so that rather than looking at every case where essentially the bidding begins, the court would like to say, well, this is more like this other case where we didn't grant a recovery, or it's more like this case where we did grant a recovery, therefore you're eligible to make your pitch to the jury, or you're not eligible to make your pitch to the jury. Now, one of the arguments that the defendant raises here to say, this defendant says, in effect, I owed no duty to the mother. What does the court say to the court? What does the court say to the defendant with respect to this argument that it owed no duty to the plaintiff? Mr. Hall? Well, before they eventually get there, but they kind of preface it by, this is on page 88 in the right-hand column, the first full paragraph, or the first paragraph that begins in that right-hand column, the assertion that liability must nevertheless be denied because defendant bears no duty to plaintiff begs the essential question whether the plaintiff's interests are entitled to legal protection against the defendant's conduct. Duty is a shorthand statement of a conclusion rather than an aid to analysis in itself. Duty is just an expression, the sum total of those considerations of policy which lead the law to say that the particular plaintiff is entitled to protection. Quoting St. Prosser. And I call this the duty schmooty response. That is, when the defendant says, wait a minute, everything hinges upon establishing the existence of the duty, the court says, what do you mean? Where did that idea come from? Duty is not something we begin with. Duty is something we finish with. It's like, you know, pouring the whipped cream on top of the dessert after it's already been prepared. It's not what you start with. It's what you finish with. When we get done deciding whether or not this woman should be able to recover, then we'll tell you whether or not the defendant owes her a duty. It doesn't work the other way around. It's not like we could ask in the abstract, well, did the defendant owe her a duty, and get somewhere from asking that question. So, in a way, again, this being an influential court, it is a way of, in some respects, sort of sweeping aside Cardozo's argument that the limits of tort liability are defined by an analysis of whether or not the defendant owed the plaintiff a duty. This court is saying, in effect, almost Andrews style, look, we decide based on public policy what we think the limits of tort liability ought to be. And when we get done with that, you can then connect the dots and say, okay, defendants who hit people in crosswalks should expect to pay parents who are standing on the porch who watch this stricken with poorer and greed. We think that makes good public policy sense. Now, defendants in that situation will be liable, and therefore we can say they owe a duty. I think Cardoza would say, in effect, you've gone over to the dark side here. You've abandoned any, you know, meaningful filter on this. Again, we're sort of rehashing a lot of these same issues about how the tort system functions, where it should derive its sort of first principles from. But, Mr. McElvenant. This court claims, I'm trying to avoid an editorial position here of saying the court is right or the court is wrong. I'm just saying it's kind of startling that they put it in this strong form to say, in effect, the duty question is meaningless. I actually read, there was a law review article, I'll see if I can... dig that up. I saw this Law Review article about 2 years ago in which it was written by somebody, I think a law professor someplace, complaining that that there was a move afoot among the American Law Institute, the restatement folks, to essentially do away with the question of duty. Not so much that the duty was irrelevant, but that duty was no longer the first step in analyzing tort liability. That as St. Prosser would have it, as the California court sees it, duty, in effect, is the label we slap on something after we've decided what we want to do with it. And this law professor wrote to say, in effect, I think we're losing something here. I think the duty question is an important one. I think it's a meaningful question. I think it should serve as the first step in analysis. But again, that's a longer-term discussion. The court, in effect, pushes aside the argument that they have to first justify the imposition of liability by first establishing that a legal duty exists. They say, we'll come up with that later on. But then they say, in effect, in deciding as a general rule who among the universe of potential claimants, mom, dad, suppose Aunt Susan is with mom, suppose grandma is standing on the porch with mom, supposing grandma and the daughter, the decedent, are very close, suppose mom's busy with something else and daughter spends most of her time with grandma. Does it make a difference? What if we call her Aunt Susan, but she's really not related by blood? Aunt Susan is actually mom's college roommate who's lived with them for a long period of time. Aunt Susan is great with kids, and Aunt Susan, we call her that, but she's really not. She's really bonded with the kids. Is she eligible? What if she's in the backyard mowing the lawn? What if she's on a business trip? How do we define who is eligible for compensation? What does the court say to that? Okay, let's take these one at a time here. The first criterion is presence at the accident scene. So it makes a difference, says the court, whether dad is running an errand at the store or whether he's standing next to mom looking at the same accident scene she is. If you're not present at the accident scene, then that's not good in terms of the plaintiff's claim that I deserve to be compensated. What's the second criterion? Okay. So we're really talking here about a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder. The psychological literature suggests that there is this phenomenon of intrusive memories, that you can't get something out of your head. You keep replaying in your mind. You're trying to concentrate on something else, and these intrusive memories keep flashing through your mind. It is the direct emotional shock. I keep replaying. I see in slow motion the car, the swerving, the screech of the brakes, the frantic cry of the children, et cetera, et cetera. I just relive this in slow motion. That's what we're trying to get, as distinguished from Dad gets a frantic phone call, he comes, he's, distraught, grieving, et cetera, et cetera, but he doesn't suffer the direct emotional shock of watching his daughter killed right in front of him. Okay? What's the third criterion? So again, we've got this spectrum. What's both attractive but also frustrating about this standard is, for each of these things, we can just move the slider bar, incrementally from the accident scene, gradually away, farther away, farther away, Chicago. We can take direct emotional shock, and again, we can show something where you get there, while the daughter's still breathing but has suffered massive internal injuries, and she only lasts another 3 minutes. She's comatose and unconscious. Or, then we move the slider bar eventually so that the doctor, and finally, closely related to the victim, well, mother and daughter, it's hard to imagine a much closer relationship in the abstract than mother and daughter, even husband and wife. It's obviously stronger in some respects, but one could argue that the parent-child, particularly the mother-child relationship, is about as strong as it gets. But then again, we could have the slider bar moving gradually to a more distant relationship, and finally we come, the first cousin once removed, pen pals, et cetera, where, again, as you move it from very close to very far away, how is this all supposed to be reconciled? Well, again, one of the reasons why Dillon versus Legg has served as the launching pad, as we'll see in Hegel versus McMahon, is this states the issue. How you decide you want to adjust these things, what really counts, is left for other courts on other days. Let me just finish here today with a question in the notes on page 91. Ballinger versus Palm Springs Aerial Tramway. Two people get on a ski gondola. In the course of the ride, something terrible goes wrong with the equipment. One of the passengers is seriously, badly mangled, gruesomely. The other one tries to help out to save the victim. They're finally rescued from this place. And the person in the gondola has no other relationship except they met in the gondola. As if you've gone skiing before and you're by yourself and you're pairing up with people and you sit down with somebody on the chairlift and you chat amiably for the 4.5 minutes it takes you to get to the top of the lift, that was the relationship here. Do you think the court would allow this plaintiff to recover? Ms. Connor? So you're saying you could get an A on the first two criteria and a D minus on the last one and still have a claim? That's what the court said. They're just factors, said the court. Now, again, trial judges faced with things like this would like a little bit more bright line paint by the numbers. And again, the constant struggle here will be, are these just sort of guideposts, suggestions, or do they operate in a more rigid way to gatekeep here, to identify you qualify, you don't? And so we'll pick up with Hagel versus McMahon, applied in the Washington context, same kind of problem. No, that's correct. These are all emotional injuries where let me begin, remind me to begin tomorrow by talking about the distinction between this case and the lady on the train. Why is it the lady on the train we said, in effect, get over it, but these people we say, oh, you're emotionally injured, how can we compensate you? So let's pick up there tomorrow.